Today's Thursday, October 4th. This is VOA's International Edition. I'm Lori London in Washington. Coming up, the U.S. Senate will review the latest FBI background check on the president's Supreme Court nominee.
Where was it? I don't know. But I had one beer. That's the only thing I remember.
Experts say President Trump could be on the hook for tens of millions in tax fraud allegations if they're substantiated. The U.S. takes further steps to punish Iran for what it calls hostile behavior. And in Africa, the First Lady visits a former slave holding facility.
It's very emotional.
It's all on today's International Edition. President Donald Trump is drawing criticism from key Republican senators over his remarks, viewed as mocking a woman who accused a Supreme Court nominee of sexual assault. Addressing thousands of supporters at a Mississippi rally, Trump gave his own reenactment of Christine Blasey Ford's responses to questions at last week's Senate hearing, where she testified that Supreme Court nominee Brett Kavanaugh assaulted her at a high school party in 1982.
36 years ago, this happened. I had one beer, right? I had one beer. Well, do you think it was? Nope, it was one beer. Oh, good. How did you get home? I don't remember. How'd you get there? I don't remember. Where is the place? I don't remember. How many years ago was it? I don't know. I don't know. I don't know. I don't know. What neighborhood was it in? I don't know. Where's the house? I don't know. Upstairs, downstairs, where was it? I don't know. But I had one beer. That's the only thing I remember.
Senator Jeff Flake, one of only a few Republicans who've given no indication how they'll vote on the nomination, said on NBC's Today Show that he was disturbed by the president's remarks.
Well, we have the statement of Dr. Ford, and then we have hours of testimony. So, frankly, when we talked about an FBI investigation, it was to follow up leads that might corroborate her account. So I'm not troubled by that.
The Federal Bureau of Investigation is looking into or has been looking into allegations against Kavanaugh, who denies that he mistreated or assaulted women. Regardless of the outcome of the FBI investigation and the actual Senate confirmation vote, the controversy has brought on a national conversation about accusations of sexual assault and how they should be dealt with. Joining us now is Ebony Tucker. She's the advocacy director for the National Alliance to End Sexual Violence. What's your perspective on the president's comments regarding Ford and also claims that young men really need to be careful of false accusations?
We were very hopeful by the president's initial comments when it came to her being seen as a sympathetic person, being seen as credible. The desire to take sexual assault allegations seriously was what we were hearing from the White House early on, and to make sure the process was done well, and that seems to have changed rather quickly, and that was definitely disappointing and not where we thought it would go.
White House Press Secretary Sarah Huckabee Sanders said that the president was just stating the facts. What are the facts when it comes to something like this with an accusation? Should men worry to some degree that they could be falsely accused? There's a fine line between who do you believe, but at the same time, you don't want to discount a woman. My understanding is that this is exactly why women are afraid to come forward.
I think that's true. I think that it's exactly why women are afraid to come forward when people don't believe them. There are a lot of reasons that advocates could talk to you about that leads to why people are so constantly in fear of false reporting. But you can look at several different studies, data from the Department of Justice, and what you'll see is that when it comes to false reporting rates, you're looking at 2 to 5% of cases having a false reporting rate. And even those numbers have some qualifiers in them that we don't have to get into. But just to be very clear, the likelihood that someone is falsely reporting a rape is a very, very small chance.
Are there any statistics for how many rape claims actually turn out to be false?
So there are in a law enforcement context. So when people are reporting to police, mm-hmm. because police still do have the ability to bring charges for false reporting a crime, and in some cases do. What we find is that happens in a very, very small percentage of cases, which was the 2 to 5% I just gave you. And there are studies that really look into that to try to figure out how often it happens. But criminal justice areas where we have any statistics we have on that, it comes from that arena. So So it is possible, just not very likely. And so I think that, you know, the problem that we have is that as a society, we look at these cases from the possible 2 to 5% instead of the 95 to 98% of people who are accurately reporting a rape. And so when you know that there's an overwhelming chance that an account of sexual assault is going to be truthful, then you should be prepared to believe people.
My understanding, though, is that another reason women don't come forward is that for the multitude of cases that are brought to law enforcement, very few end up being prosecuted. Is that accurate?
That's correct. That is accurate. And that is an issue that I think has, quite frankly, divided the advocacy and prosecutorial community for quite some time. I don't think that all advocates and prosecutors get along really well. And that's a part of the reason where we will feel very strongly along with survivors that cases should be prosecuted. Prosecutors have a right that, quite frankly, is almost impenetrable to decline cases. And so sometimes that happens due to resources, number of prosecutors, and also the likelihood that they can actually get a conviction.
What has your organization been dealing with since this whole saga began? Have you had a lot of calls? What are you seeing as a result of all of this?
We're seeing really strong, amazing mobilization of survivor advocates, which has been really, really trying to inform people when we see that there are a lot of attempts to misinform people about the way that survivors act or what is a credible witness and that kind of thing. So we've been trying to give good education there. And that's been most of our work. And also, I think, being very clear with our legislators, particularly our senators, that we often work with on other policy initiatives like the Violence Against Women Act, that we take the support and the belief of survivors very seriously, and those things cannot be disrespected. And then you can't disrespect what survivors need after a trauma and then call yourself champions for women's issues and gender-based violence. So we've really been trying to make sure that those messages are there.
What about women that feel re-traumatized over all of this? Have you been hearing from them?
We have. We don't run a hotline through our office, but we have had conversations with a lot of our partners who do that work. Rain, who has a national hotline, as well as some states who run state hotlines, have told us that there's been a significant uptick in the number of calls they've received. It's been really re-traumatizing, not just having to hear about sexual assault so often on TV, seeing it on social media, hearing about it in the news, but then also I think what has been a negative response from some, particularly around social media, around the issue of sexual assault and not believing survivors, I think is also really re-traumatizing for a lot of people.
All right, that's Ebony Tucker, Advocacy Director for the National Alliance to End Sexual Violence. The death toll of the devastating earthquake and tsunami in Indonesia continues to rise, with scores of uncounted bodies believed to still be buried in collapsed buildings. AP correspondent Zuria Shakely reports on this.
Indonesia's national disaster spokesman says official death toll increased to 1,407, with thousands injured and more than 70,000 displaced from their homes. Aid is slowly making its way into areas devastated by the twin disasters. Many roads are broken and split by the violent shaking or blocked by debris, and communications remain limited. Food, water, fuel, and medicine are still slow to reach the hardest hit areas outside Palu, the largest city heavily damaged in Friday's disaster. I'm Zuria Shakely.
Well, the UN says its humanitarian office is reporting that needs are vast, with people urgently requiring shelter, clean water, food, and emergency medical care. And the UN Children's Fund is warning tens of thousands of child survivors are unprotected and vulnerable to exploitation. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from Geneva.
The full extent of the disaster is still emerging, but the UN Children's Fund says it is very worried about its impact upon the children, as they are most vulnerable in crisis emergency situations. UNICEF says it is especially concerned about the children's welfare and safety, as the Sulawesi tsunami follows by 1 month the earthquake in the holiday island of Lombok. That event killed 550 people and displaced 340,000. The agency reports children comprise more than one-third of the population of central Sulawesi. It says 43% of the children live in poverty. As a result of poor nutrition, it says a great many children suffer from chronic malnutrition or stunting. This condition makes children more prone to disease and infection and impairs their physical and mental development. UNICEF spokesman Christophe Bouygerac says his agency is very concerned about the many children who are likely to have become orphaned or separated from their parents by the disaster and have no one to protect them.
This is also a region with a low birth registration. Only 33% of children are registered. And birth registration is of paramount importance in terms of child protection. It is a passport to protection. This low birth registration is an issue for family tracing process, in addition to well-known risk of exploitation and trafficking.
Children who have no birth certificate are officially invisible. They cannot access basic services such as health, social welfare, and education. They are at risk of being trafficked, sexually exploited, and forced into child labor. UNICEF says it is deploying social workers to the affected areas to provide psychosocial services for separated and unaccompanied children and to trace and reunify families. It is appealing for $5 million to provide essential needs. These include medical and health services, water and sanitation, food and non-food items, and emergency shelter. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Here are some of the stories we're following at voanews.com. Former Russian spy finds it hard to accept Moscow tried to kill him. Melania Trump visits ex-slave holding facility in Ghana. Indonesia's president returns to the disaster scene as the death toll rises. And when violence flares, Ethiopia continues to turn off the internet. Find expanded coverage of these stories and more at voanews.com and on our VOA mobile app. This is International Edition. The United States is pulling out of a 63-year-old treaty with Iran in response to the International Court of Justice, ordering the United States to lift nuclear-related sanctions on Tehran that involve medicine, food, and airplane parts.
I'm announcing that the United States is terminating the 1955 Treaty of Amity with Iran. This is a decision, frankly, that is 39 years overdue.
That's Secretary of State Mike Pompeo. The Treaty of Amity established economic relations and consular rights between the two countries long before the 1979 Islamic Revolution in Iran. The withdrawal marks the latest indication of escalating tensions between Washington and Tehran. Iran had complained, though, to the UN court that the move by Washington to reimpose sanctions, which had been lifted under the 2015 International Nuclear Agreement, violated the 1955 treaty. Pompeo said in response to that,
Iran is attempting to interfere with the sovereign rights of the United States to take lawful actions necessary to protect our national security. And Iran is abusing the ICJ for political and propaganda purposes.
Meanwhile, National Security Advisor John Bolton said another immediate withdrawal ordered by President Trump is from the optional protocol on dispute resolution to the Vienna Convention.
This is in connection with a case brought by the so-called State of Palestine, naming the United States as a defendant, challenging our move of our embassy from Tel Aviv to Jerusalem.
VOA's Victor Beatty spoke with Indiana University Assistant Professor Hussein Banai about the implications of the moves by the United States and asked what Iran was hoping to accomplish by going to the international court.
I don't know if it was a very symbolic act on their part. They were trying to demonstrate yet again that when it comes to international law, that they have the upper hand in the argument against the United States. And the United States was the country that was actually imposing the sanctions against the international consensus, but also against provisions in international law. So this was a very big symbolic victory for Iran. It doesn't mean that it would be abided by in practice, of course, as the American response indicates, but they have yet another data point in their case that the United States is the one that is acting against international law and not them.
Pompeo said the administration would proceed with sanctions enforcement with existing exemptions for humanitarian and flight safety transactions. So there are exemptions in these sanctions.
There are, but obviously the United States can always pull back and say Iran is using these humanitarian exemptions or it's exploiting them for other purposes. The United States can always come back, as they did in the case of Iraq, for instance, back when Saddam Hussein was still in charge, to allege that there are dual uses to certain products, such as spare parts for airplanes, for instance, that can be used for military purposes or it would use to strengthen the regime. So how much of this is actually going to pan out in practice, we have to see case by case.
Iran, when it opened the case back in July before the International Court of Justice, during 4 days of hearings in August, accused Washington of strangling its economy. Is that what's going on?
Well, it's very clear that the U.S. sanctions are having a profound effect already, and a big portion of the sanctions have not even gone into effect yet, the sanction against Iran's oil products that are scheduled to go into effect shortly. Iran's economy is absolutely reeling as a result of these decisions that really limit the activity of any international company, not just American company, but any international company that also does business with the United States to do business with Iran. So that has hurt Iran's economy and it has hurt Iran's ability to cash in on some of the deals that it had signed with European and Asian companies after the nuclear accord was signed. And so the United States action is absolutely responsible for the dire state of the Iranian economy at the moment.
On his Twitter account, following the ruling, Iran's foreign minister, Mohammad Javad Zarif, praised the court, saying that it was another failure for sanctions-addicted U.S., victory for the rule of law. He said it was imperative for other countries to, quote, collectively counter malign U.S. unilateralism, and he accused the U.S. of being an outlaw regime.
It's very interesting how the tables have turned. It wasn't that long ago that then United Nations Ambassador Zarif would defend Iran's denunciations by international institutions and bodies, a sign of them kowtowing to American interests. And now he's kind of turned the tables. And obviously with some justification, Iran's case has been seen, the way the grievances have been registered have been seen as such by the international court. I'm not sure if this has anything beyond the symbolic value, as I said earlier, but they're going to maximize whatever advantage they can get out of this, especially when it comes to keeping the Europeans as part of the nuclear deal, as partners, as defenders of Iran's interests against the United States.
Well, as you indicated, another phase of U.S. sanctions goes into effect in November, targeting Iran's oil sector. What is Iran's strategy going forward?
It's very unclear. Iran can get very creative with respect to how it is going to basically sell its oil to countries that are not doing business with the United States. But it is going to be ultimately severely limited because of its lack of access to international markets and international exchange indices, especially. And obviously, all the big companies and the rates that Iran will hope to get in return for its oil are going to be significantly lower than what it would normally get for its oil. So we'll have to see just how creative they get. They've been here before, but this time around it's going to be more tough because the sanctions are far more sweeping.
That's Indiana University Assistant Professor Hussein Banai. First Lady Melania Trump said Wednesday she will never forget her visit to a former slave-holding facility on Ghana's coast. She called it very emotional and really something people should see and experience.
The dungeons that I saw, it's really something that people should see and experience, and what happened so many years ago, it's really a tragedy.
U.S. First Lady spent nearly an hour on a guided tour of the 17th century castle, which originally was built by the Swedes for the trading of timber and gold, but eventually became a warehouse for slaves shipped to the New World. She spent about 10 minutes inside the dark, cramped dungeon where male slaves were housed, then walked down a pathway leading to the door of no return, where slaves were shipped to the New World with no hope of returning to Africa. And then she walked out the back door, laid a wreath, observed a moment of silence, and signed a guest book. Former President Barack Obama toured the castle with his family in 2009 and said it was a reminder of the capacity of human beings to commit great evil. Mrs. Trump also plans stops this week in Malawi, Kenya, and Egypt. You're listening to International Edition on VOA.
What want to relax, unwind, or charge up? Then listen to Music Time in Africa this weekend. It'll do all that for you and more. I'm Heather Maxwell. I know good music. And Africa is my passion. Join me every Saturday and Sunday for 1 hour of commercial-free Pan-African music of the highest caliber. You get great music, music news, and amazing artist interviews from rising stars to superstars. This listen will take you places. So do it. Join me for Music Time in Africa, your weekend destination.
VOA's International Edition continues. Finding the motivation to get in shape can be difficult, but a new category of smart mirrors won't let users off the hook. Tina Trin reports.
For all the gym selfies on Instagram, maybe it was only a matter of time before mirrors started giving us a dose of reality.
Naked is a full-length mirror. It has 3D depth sensors embedded in it. You stand on a scale that rotates you through 360 degrees in 15 seconds.
And 15 seconds is all it takes to see the effects of diet and exercise on your body. The mirror's built-in depth sensors generate a 3D model, downloading key stats such as body fat and muscle mass to your phone. Naked's creators say the visual factor is the most compelling for people trying to lose weight.
They're developing muscle at the same rate that they're losing fat. Their weight plateaus, and in their mind, they immediately think that I'm not making any progress. When in reality, their body shape is changing drastically.
But it's not the only company using mirrors as motivational tools. Another device, simply dubbed Mirror, offers live fitness classes that are streamed from a studio in New York straight to users' living rooms.
A lot of the spend that's happening in gyms is actually moving to the home as well.
Mirror's LCD display and built-in camera lets instructors provide real-time feedback while they work out simultaneously with other logged-in class members. The device also lets you sync a Bluetooth heart rate monitor and work towards a target heart rate. When the gym is at home, it's one less excuse for not working out. And while Naked is relatively expensive, its founders think it will be money well spent.
They've tried different diets, they've tried different exercise programs. It hasn't worked. They see Naked as a way to have more clarity around what's happening to their body.
So if those gym selfies aren't motivating you, perhaps looking in the mirror will get you off the couch. Tina Trin, VOA News, New York.
The latest version of a film classic opens this weekend. VOA's Border Crossings host Larry London joined International Edition's Sarah Williams with details about the new film and its music.
We've got a song from what will most likely be the number one film at the box office this weekend when it opens up on Friday. The soundtrack for the film is also coming out. I'm talking about the movie A Star Is Born. This is not the third version of the film. This is the fourth version, actually, because the original film came out in 1937, starring Janet Gaynor and Frederick March. And then it was redone three times after that. 1954, Judy Garland and James Mason. 1976, Barbra Streisand and Kris Kristofferson. And now we've got the team of Lady Gaga and Bradley Cooper. Now he's not only starring in the new film A Star Is Born, he's also directing the film as well, which was very interesting for him. He said to be director and actor, he said it was quite frankly easy. It was an easier transition. You'd think it'd be harder,
yeah.
But he's in the midst of roles, in the midst of doing things. Like, there's a love scene with him and Lady Gaga's character, Allie, and he said it was easier. It was easier than standing behind a camera yelling, cut, action, more, less, whatever. He was doing it himself. Now, Clint Eastwood was originally set to direct the new version, and he had been working on it for a couple of years. Beyoncé was supposed to be Allie. But there were some problems along the way, negotiations, other issues. Clint bailed out of the project, and Bradley Cooper took over in 2015. And Lady Gaga stepped in as well as Ali. So the song is out. I want to give everybody a chance to hear this song because It's already debuted at number 14 on the All Genres chart and number 4 on the Pop Digital Sales chart, and this is only in half of a week, so you can look forward to bigger numbers after a full week come next week. Lady Gaga and Mark Ronson wrote the song. It's sung by Lady Gaga and Bradley Cooper, believe it or not, and it's called Shallow.
Tell me something, girl. Are you happy in this modern world? Or do you need more? Is there something else you're searching for?
I've seen some previews of this film, and it looks like it'll be really good.
Yeah, well, everybody that's reviewed it so far, USA Today, Newsweek, Time, the LA Times, Hollywood Reporter, everybody said the chemistry between Lady Gaga and Bradley Cooper is just undeniable. The performances are electrifying. I'm using words that I've taken from some of these reviews. The film is going to be a hit. There's no two ways about it. You've got the appeal of Bradley Cooper, as I mentioned, an established actor. And you've got Lady Gaga, who's got her little monsters. That's what she calls her legion of fans. And she brings today's pop culture into the dynamic. So this is going to be great. Now, Lady Gaga and Bradley Cooper performed that song on stage this past summer at one of the biggest music festivals in all of Europe, the Glastonbury Music Festival. Bradley said for years and years he's gone as a fan to watch the festival. This time he got to perform music on stage, and he thanks Kris Kristofferson for sharing 4 minutes of what was his set during the Glastonbury Festival to allow him and Lady Gaga to come out and do this. People have asked, you know, Bradley Cooper, he sings. Wow. Who knew that?
I didn't know that.
He said he's been taking singing lessons 5 days a week for the last few months to get ready for this role. He always sang in the shower, in the car, driving to work, but never on film like this before. So he took some professional training, and we already know about Lady Gaga's past success and all of the things she's done. You forget about the fact that she performed a tribute to Sound of Music on the Oscars a few years
right.
back, and everybody was just mesmerized at how great a singer she actually is. And she is, and she does a great job in her role as Allie in this movie. I'm so excited to see this. The soundtrack comes out as well this weekend. There are 4 duets with Lady Gaga and Bradley Cooper. He's got 5 solo songs himself on the soundtrack,
wow.
and she's got 8 solo songs. So this is going to be a great soundtrack and a great film. I'm so excited.
And I should just say, I read in the Washington Post just yesterday that apparently in the film, Lady Gaga sings a little bit, I don't know the whole song, but it's Somewhere Over the Rainbow, kind of a tribute to Judy Garland, who starred in an earlier version of that.
And she thanked Bradley Cooper for all of his inspiration, his guidance in the film. He actually wrote the screenplay for this film, taking adaptations from the previous 3 versions. Lady Gaga said he was a great director to work with, and it was his idea to do some of the things, the set design, he was involved with wearing less makeup or no makeup at all, so it gave a real natural raw effect. Bradley Cooper's character is a guy who's near the end of his musical career, and Allie, Lady Gaga's character, is at the start of her music career. So this is kind of a love story, love of music, love of one another, and I think everybody's going to fall in love. There's going to be laughter, and there's going to be tears. It's going to be a great movie. Finally, a real good feel-good film, A Star is Born, and the new song, Shallow, the first song from the soundtrack.
Thanks very much, Larry. That's Larry London. He's the host of VOA's Border Crossing.
In the shallow, in the shallow, shallow, in the shallow, shallow, we're far from the shallow now.
VOA brings you the best in African music on the African Beat. African Beat showcases the latest and the greatest of contemporary African music, from bobo music to hip life, bonga flavor to soukous, Afrobeat to ndombolo and makossa to kwaito. The African Beat on VOA has it all. And it's happening right here, Mondays through Fridays at 09:05 and 20:05 UTC, right after the international news.
You've been listening to International Edition. That does it for today, but find us anytime at voanews.com. Thanks so much for joining us. Thanks to our director, Tracy Carter, and our engineer, Greg Burns. I'm Lori London in Washington. Have a great day.